All right. Well, everybody knows this is the place where I have fallen into a rut because I tend to say something similar just about every week, and it goes something like this. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. This is where we part from week to week because the next part is that would be Exodus or Shemot chapter 35, starting right at the beginning, verse 1. And it says, Vayechel Moshe et Kol Edat. B'nai Israel in the Hebrew, okay? So we know most of that. That first word there, Vay Yekel. So Vay is and. Yekel. That's interesting. Okay. If we know the root there is Kahal, right? The Hebrew word Kahal, which means to assemble. Or it's also used as an assembly. So the verb says, and Moshe assembled. Vay Yekel, Moshe. Et, what did he assemble, right? Et points to the thing, kol edat, all of the congregation. And that's the word, I like that word a lot better than circus or Circe or any of those kind of things. The assembly is kol edat, the entire assembly, all of B'nai Israel, all the children of Israel. And he said to them the following, these are the words which Yahuwah has commanded that you should do them. All right, let's pause here for just a second, because essentially what we're going to have is a kind of an interesting, as it turns out, a reprise in a lot of respects of some things that we've seen before. Matter of fact, we've seen them several times over the last few weeks, the parshot of Terumah, Tetzaveh, and last week, Ki Tisa, that talked about the elements and the gifts and the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the wilderness. So we're going to get a reprise of that. What kind of has always fascinated me about this one is the way it starts. He assembles everybody together. What's he going to tell them? About how, you know, Jesus is going to come. We're going to go do Sun God Day, right? Because Ishtar, the sun goddess, was... No, he doesn't say a word about that. He repeats something he said over and over and over and over again. A commandment that has not been done away with still. And it says, 6 days work shall be done. Seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest to Yahuwah, to be set apart, kadosh, this sounds kind of serious, almost like it might be important. Whoever does any work therein shall be put to death. So the part about this that I always think is interesting is twofold. One, he's not only mentioned it before and emphasized it before, but now he's repeating it, and it leads into all of the stuff that's going to follow in this Torah portion. So it's kind of a... Well, it's an interesting segue, right? Going to talk about the Sabbath, and then he's going to talk about building all the things for him, a place for him to dwell among them. And he reminds them that it contains a death penalty. So I look at all of that. We had some discussions earlier here over the last day or so about you know, some of the differences with the what I sometimes refer to perhaps a little bit derogatorily as the Sun God Day Church, and the things that we have been told that God didn't get right the first time, so we had to change it. And maybe we should listen to the Pope, because he knows better than the creator of the universe, who said he wasn't going to change it, and who kept making that point over and over again, and even saying it has a death penalty. Yeah, somehow or other, there's a big disconnect here, and it's more important than people would like to admit. And then it has this thing, you shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations upon the Sabbath day. One of the other things I usually point out is, if you go through the entire Tanakh, look at all the places where there are specific strictures, do's and don'ts on the Sabbath day, you can pretty much count them on two hands. There aren't that many. Now, by the time of Yeshua, as a lot of folks know, there were, in fact, more. The Pharisees of the day, the rabbis of the day, had added an additional, 1,600 plus. How far you can walk, how far you can't. If you throw a rock, how big it can be, you got to go pick it up if you throw it too far. You know, a bunch of things you go, what? So they had really been piling burden upon burden. But it's interesting because here's one of the few places where there really is a restriction. Pretty straightforward and simple. You'll kindle no fire throughout your habitations. Now, some of you know that among the Orthodox, and I at least can respect that there is an understanding about the verse, they'll say, well, we can't drive on the Sabbath because when you kick that little key, it makes fire, kindles fire. You know, 3,600 RPMs, 3,600 little fires per second. Well, maybe. Honestly, having kindled a fire as a Boy Scout, I'll tell you, it ain't the same. It's a lot more work to kindle a fire than it is to go, brum, and turn a key. So I don't quite see the connection, although at least I can respect the idea. Well, okay, we're saying that if it looks like a fire, it might be. Okay, flipping on a light switch. Well, again, similar kind of logic applies. To my mind, that's not work, and I'm certainly not getting paid to do it either. All right, what does Moshe tell him? He says, you speak all of the congregation, the children of Israel. There it is again. Kol ha-edat of the B'nai Israel. Tell them the following. This is the thing which Yahuwah has commanded. Here's what he says. Take from among you an offering unto Yahuwah. Now, here's where I pause again. Whoever is of a willing heart. We know that that word in the Hebrew, lev, is the root there for heart. Willing heart. Let him bring it. Going to have a description of what it is. But I want to point out before we go through this, this word heart, lev, is going to appear over and over and over and over again in the next, well, chapter or two. Well, along with some interesting modifiers. So we'll mention those as we get to them. Here's what they are being told that they can bring if they have this wonderful thing, this willing heart. Gold, silver, brass, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red, seal skins, or whatever the word is. That's one of those words that I'm not sure we know exactly what the animal was. Some kind of skin, anyway. And acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil, and for the sweet incense, onyx stones, stones to be used in the ephod and the breastplate. And then it says this, and let every wise-hearted man... That Hebrew word there is kind of cool, chakom, wise. And it's good to be chakom. Wise-hearted man among you come. Make all that Yahuwah has commanded. And here we get a listing of about 39 things that are going to be made. And there's some interesting Hebrew words in there. I won't go through all of them. But I will point out two things. Not only is there a list of these 39 items, like the tabernacle, the tent. Okay, so ha-mishkan, there's the tabernacle. Et ha-ohel, there you go. Tent, covering, clasp, boards, bars, pillars, sockets, ark. The staves thereof, the ark cover, the veil, the table, the staves, the vessels, the showbread, candlestick, the menorah, there's that word, vessels, lamps, oil for the light, altar of incense, and on down through. All of the things, the hangings of the court, the sockets, pins, plated garments, all the stuff Aaron and his sons are going to wear to minister in the priest's office. What's interesting in here is va'et and et. You could say aleph tav, okay, because that's the Hebrew root word. A lot of people will... and I don't have a problem with noting that the Aleph and the Tav, when Yahushua says it in Revelation, is a reference to the beginning and the end, and it's probably no coincidence that that word, the et, Aleph Tav, and it even doesn't really translate to English, if you understand that. What it is, it's called the pointer to the direct object. I remember reading that for about 2 years before it ever occurred to me, what the heck are they really talking about, right? We don't have it in English. If I say, the man threw the ball is the direct object. It's the thing that got done too, right? The ball is the thing that was thrown. And in Hebrew, you would say, man threw et ha-ball. Okay, and the et says, that's what he threw. You put the et in there to show what it is. And what's interesting is, because in English, you have to put them in order. Okay, it wouldn't make sense to say the ball threw the man. Well, no, that means something different. But in Hebrew, I can simply put the et in there, and it says, here's what's getting thrown. The verb acts on this thing. Well, the aleph tav is also, in a way, the thing that acts. It's the element, it is a key, and it appears over and over and over and over and over again in this list. And I find that kind of fascinating. So I went through my study Bible and literally highlighted all the places where it says et this, et that, va et this, and va et that, right? Va et and also this pointing to this thing. When it's all said and done, it says, and all of the congregation, there it is again, Kol Edat, B'nai Israel, departed from the presence of Moshe, and they came. All of them. Well, wait a minute. Everyone whose heart stirred him up. Everyone whose ruach, his spirit, made him willing, and brought the offering of Yahuwah for the work of the tent of meeting, for all the service and all the holy garments, and they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted. They brought all kinds of rings, nose rings, earrings, signet rings, girdles, jewels of gold, every man that brought an offering of gold unto Yahuwah. And every man with whom was found blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair, all those skins and things brought them. Everyone that did set apart an offering of silver and brass brought the offering to Yahuwah. Or actually, it's his offering. Every man with whom was found acacia wood for any work of the service, they brought that. The women that were, what? They were hachomat. Feminine version, same word. Hachom, wise, hearted. They spun with their hands. They brought that which they had spun, the blue, the purple, the scarlet, the fine linen. And those whose heart stirred them up, the women stirred them up, even in wisdom. Be hachoma. In Hachoma, spun the goat's hair. And the rulers, the princes, they brought the onyx stones, the stones to be set for the ephod and the breastplate, the spice, the oil, and the sweet incense. And this is kind of interesting. Now, a lot of times the English doesn't quite get it right here. And most of the versions I've looked at, it says, the children of Israel brought a freewill offering unto Yahuwah. But no, that's not what it says. It says, Kol Ish Ve Isha. All of what? Kol of Ish, the men, and Isha, the women, brought a freewill offering to Yahuwah. Every man and woman, ready, whose heart made them willing to bring for all the works which Yahuwah had commanded by the hand of Moshe to be made. And Moshe said to the B'nai Israel, see, Yahuwah has called by name these two folks, Bezalel, Bezalel. Okay, we know that ending word there, El, is in the shadow of the creator, El. Elohim, it's that word that means God, or gets translated as God in English. Bezalel, in the shadow of El. And as I've seen people point out, you know, when you look in the Bible and ask whose name really nails it, what kind of names really say this is what this guy did, Bezalel is probably close to the top of the list. Everything he did was literally in the shadow of El and for his purposes. I've got a really nice piece that I remember looking at. I may or may not touch on it this evening. Maybe we'll talk about it tomorrow. By a rabbi that I admire, about the shadow that's cast by Elohim. And here's the guy. And it all has to do with this, I will mention this part of it, this concept that he calls kind of a Jewish concept, very much at odds with the Greek concept. Okay, in other words, in the Hebraic history, you don't see a whole lot of emphasis on artisans. Right, the men of Yah, it's not a major thing that was a big deal, with exceptions like these two folks, that they were artisans. Ancient Greece, on the other hand, right, you got all the people that make great these statues and so forth. Well, obviously, one of the reasons had to do with this issue of making graven images, sculptures. So that's part of it. The claim is, well, it's one thing to do 2D drawings and illustrations, but 3D sculptures, that crosses that line in a lot of opinions. But what caught my eye was this line, okay? The artisan, the craftsman, the shaper of beauty in the service of Elohim, these two guys, Bezalel, along with Aholiab, the tent of my father, made all of these things. And it's unusual because the Hebrews didn't emphasize that, whereas the ancient Greeks, of course, they were really big on all of that stuff. Beauty was a major deal. And here is the line that he gets to that I think is kind of interesting. The idea here is that the understanding of Torah, and he says Judaism, I'll say in a larger sense, the Torah and the worship of the way the Creator wants us to worship is more about the ear than it is about the eye. Hear. Faith comes by hearing. Hearing by the word of Yah. We see that emphasized over and over again. It's a very Hebraic concept. It is the word of Yah that matters. He is a God, an Elohim that is invisible. And we're not to emphasize that. And that's part of the reason why this idea of making these graven images so you have something to look at is such a failure. So the idea is that the sanctity is in the words that are heard, not in the objects that are seen. So, again, I thought that was an interesting observation. And yet, having said all of that, we're going to spend some time in this portion, unique because it is kind of unique, talking about these two guys and all the things that they made and all the people who came and made them because they had wise, willing hearts. Heart, 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 over and over again. That's what counts. Oh, and there's this. Verse 31 says, and he, meaning Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, filled him with the Spirit. With what? Ha-Ruach Elohim. The Spirit of Elohim. In wisdom, hachom, and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship. So he could devise skillful works to work in gold, silver, and brass, cutting of stones, carving of wood, you name it, he was good at it. And Yahuwah put in his heart that he might teach his skills, both he and Aholiab, son of Ahisamach, the tribe of Dan. Them he filled with, here it is again, wisdom of heart, hachomat lev, to work all manner of workmanship, the craftsman, the skillful workman, the weaver in colors, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen, of the weaver, them that do workmanship, those that devise skillful works. And Betzalel and Aholiab shall work, along with every wise-hearted man in whom Yahuwah has put wisdom and understanding to know how to work all of the work for the service of the sanctuary, according to all that Yahuwah has commanded. Now here I pause again. Okay, I emphasized up front, well, actually Scripture emphasized, I'm trying to just read it. It doesn't start out with all of this jazz about all the work that's going to be done and all this bringing of the offering. It starts out with, keep my Sabbaths, set apart my appointed times. And then we talk about this, almost, try this on for size, almost like something associated with walking in obedience to him, setting aside the day that he says is to be a day of solemn rest. Keep my Moedim throughout your generations forever, Ha'olam. It's about life. And then he puts all of this wisdom in the hearts of all these people so that they can do the works and bring forth this place for him to dwell among them. I find that kind of downright amazing and consistent. So they received of Moshe all the offering children of Israel had brought for the work of the service of sanctuary to make it. They brought him free will offerings every morning. And the wise men that wrought all the work of the sanctuary, they came, they brought what they'd wrought. They spoke with Moshe and they said, you know what? These folks are bringing a whole lot of stuff, man. This is more stuff, more than enough for the service of the work which Yahuwah commanded to make. I guess you could say their cups literally overflowed. Then Moshe gave a commandment. He said he caused it to be proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, all right, let neither man nor woman make any more work for the offering of the sanctuary. So the people were restrained from bringing. Now here is the verse that I love, and I have seen lots of what I think is really cool commentary, midrash, on this. And as you know, when it comes to understanding the Hebrew, I'm kind of a Rashi fan. I think the guy does a great job of nailing some of the concepts that might otherwise kind of almost flit over our heads before we stop to grab them and look at them. Verse 7 says, for the stuff that they had was sufficient for all the work to make it, and too much. Huh? Well, which is it? It was sufficient, and it was too much. Now, the beauty of that is that essentially it was more than enough, but all that was necessary. And the way the Midrash has put it that I find so wonderful is, look, you guys have gone above and beyond the call of duty. It is about the fact that there is enough. There's indeed more than enough, but understand that everything that you did was in fact also necessary. Mathematicians talk about a necessary and sufficient condition, and I think that's the beauty of this. In other words, everyone's contribution is appreciated, everyone's contribution was important, and yet, it's not like you can say, hey, I did this and nobody else. No, no. All of it was necessary, it was wonderful, it was more than sufficient, and that's great. So where are we again? Well, back to every wise-hearted man among them that wrought the work, made the tabernacle. Now what we're going to have is kind of a shift of gears and a little bit of that repetition I was talking about. Numbers, concepts, and things that ultimately sound kind of redundant. Now, I always encourage folks, even if I kind of slide over some of the stuff that we think sounds redundant, I encourage people to read through it all. Because, as you know, there's no idle word in Torah. It's all there for a reason. And in some years, as I go through this, I will wax a little bit more focused on certain aspects than others. As a nerdy engineer, I tend to think, oh, well, when you see redundancy in something, understand a redundancy is really cool. Okay, redundancy is a way that you can use to avoid errors. Okay, engineers have parity check codes and stuff. Well, in the Torah, there are things that are there also that can help us avoid errors. If I say the same thing twice, I can say, well, did I get the same thing both times? If I didn't, maybe something's wrong. Well, either that or maybe there's a difference that's being emphasized. So anytime you see redundancy, it's really cool to go back and compare what the same list said the first time. Is it word for word, letter for letter the same, or is it similar? Do the differences give us additional information? Often they do. All right. In this case, what I'm going to suggest is that, there's a lot of detail. Sometimes the order is a bit different. There's probably a lot more in those differences than I have the intellectual fortitude to really be able to ferret out or even to claim that I can understand. But I do know this. What we're seeing here in this list and this repetition are two tellings of something that's similar. Okay, first. Well, you know, I like to emphasize this a lot of times. We're told, all that Old Testament. I don't even like that term, Old Testament. It's like the New Testament did away with the old stuff. We don't have to worry about that anymore. No. The Mashiach made it really clear, not one yod or tittle. It's all important. Even stuff that sounds like it's redundant. Maybe especially if it's redundant. Two tellings. So what do we make of this idea of the two tellings? Well, let me go through just a bit of it. The length of its curtain. Each curtain, there's 10 of them, it says. They're fine twine linen. And how many times do we see this? A blue, purple, scarlet? Oh, and cherubim, the work of these skillful workmen. He made them. The length of each curtain, 8 and 20 cubits. The breadth, 4 cubits. All the curtains were the same. They had the same measure. Okay, so they're 8, they're 28 by 4 cubits in size. He coupled 5 curtains, one to another. Made loops of blue upon them. And then we're going to have a description of how the curtains are assembled together with loops. 50 loops in one, 50 loops in the edge of the other. They were set opposite. There were clasps of gold, of course. 50 of those to tie the curtains, couple them one to another. There were curtains of goat's hair for the tent over the tabernacle. 11 of those. Each of those with 30 cubits and 4 cubits wide. So same width, a couple cubits longer. And so forth. Coupled the 5 curtains and the 6 curtains together, made 50 loops in the edge of the first set, 50 loops in the edge of the second set, 50 clasps to put them together, covering for the tent of ram's skin dyed red, covering of seal skins above, so this is a layered thing. Boards, as we know, out of acacia wood, standing up 10 cubits by a cubit and a half. And each of them had two tenets and sockets and so forth, the numbers and the description of all of that. All right, so we've seen this, we've talked about it, we've been through it. Two tellings. What's the point of two tellings? And here, people tend to wax perhaps a little bit mystical even, philosophical. Of course, you know about the multiple levels of depth in the Scripture. Maybe there is something that's deeper here. But there's a few things that are obvious. I've mentioned one, it's just redundant. It's like maybe you weren't listening the first time. I'm going to tell you again. It emphasizes that it's important. Here's another way to think of it. How about, here's what you're going to do. Now I'm going to tell you what they did. Here's what you're supposed to do. Here's what they did. Hey, they ought to be the same, right? All that Moshe was commanded and all that they were told to do, they did. And it even tells us that at some point. So there's that. That's kind of cool. I have seen people suggest, you know what? There's a teaching about Mashiach ben, first one, Joseph, and then the return, Mashiach ben David, son of David, two advents of the Mashiach. Well, maybe we got a similar indication here. Tell me twice. It didn't take the first time. Similar, and this is the one that I think kind of resonated with me when I saw it. What have we just finished talking about last week? I told you some stuff. And then what do you go and do? You go and tell me, here's how we're going to worship God. Okay, I'm going to make a golden calf. Now, he's just finished saying he doesn't like that. What are we going to do? Yeah, you got to like it. You'll love this. We're going to do it anyway. We're going to say, tomorrow is Aaron even. We're going to have a feast for Yahuwah. Wrong. I told you what I wanted, what I didn't want, and here you went and done it anyway. How's that for, chutzpah, I guess we would say. And, of course, that, too, is another one of those things we see in the modern world all the time. God says he doesn't like it, but he doesn't know what he really wants. He says he doesn't like Christmas and Ishtar Sun God Day and all this pagan stuff. He doesn't like children being run through the fire to Molech. Well, hell, we got New York City. We'll kill them en masse, and we'll do it after birth, and we know better. We don't even like him anyway. So we get there a little at a time. But the real message, I think, that resonates in this is, he told them what he wanted. He told them what he didn't want. They did it anyway. He was fixing to kill them. We have that really interesting scenario with Moshe. And then what do we get? We get another telling. You know what? It's almost like he said, look, I told you. You didn't listen. I'm going to tell you again. Do you understand here that there can, in fact, be redemption? Do you understand that even though you didn't do what I wanted, and I didn't kill you, now here's what I'm going to tell you again. Let's get it right this time. There is a place for redemption. And that is, in fact, another big part of the pattern. So I saw it put this way, and I like this phraseology. His purposes were not thwarted in spite of our rebellion. And to me, that resonates, of course, because, as you know, we are still in exile. Northern kingdoms, 10 lost tribes, sent out whoring wife for cause, given a certificate of divorce and told, going to scatter you. But there comes a time when they'll be regathering. So again, this idea of tell me twice. We clearly need to be told at least twice. All right, let's continue. Chapter 37, after this partial repetition here, is going to tell us a bit more. Bezalel, in the shadow of El, he made what? The ark out of acacia wood. 2 cubits and a half was the length of it, and 1.5 cubits the breadth of it. And it was 1.5 cubits high. As we've already heard, he overlaid it exactly as prescribed with pure gold, inside and outside. Made a crown of gold round about, cast the 4 rings in the 4 feet, 2 rings on one side, 2 rings on the other side. He made staves so that it could be carried out of acacia wood. They were overlaid with gold. Put them in the rings on the opposite sides of the ark to bear it. And he made the ark cover out of pure gold. 2.5 cubits was the length, 1.5 cubits the breadth, so it fit right on top of the ark. He made 2 cherubim out of gold. Beaten work he made them at 2 ends of the ark cover, one at one end, the other at the other end, 1 piece with the ark cover at the 2 ends. And they spread out their wings on high, screening the ark cover with their wings, facing toward one another. Toward the ark cover were the faces. Here's another bit of redundancy. With their faces, one to another, toward the ark cover were the faces of the cherubim. He made the table out of acacia wood, 2 cubits by 1 cubit, and 1.5 cubits the height. That too was overlaid with pure gold, crown of gold around it, and a border around that. He has 4 rings to be able to bear that one as well. Close by the border were the rings, the staves. So it, like the ark, is going to be borne up on these 2 staves or long sticks that the people would carry it by. He made the vessels on top of the table, the dishes, the pans, bowls, jars, things to pull out. All of those were pure gold. He made the menorah candlestick. This is one of those places where I wish they'd just left the word. Made the menorah out of pure gold, of beaten work he made it. Even its base, its shaft, its cups, its knops, flowers with 1 piece of it. Now, the other thing that the sages will point out is, as a general rule, right, we're told not to make representations of things in the earth. That would seem to include things like almond blossoms and flowers and stuff. But here is the notable exception. This is, of course, a very singular exception. So it's described in some detail. To my mind, what's always been the most fascinating about this, of course, there's 3 branches on one side, 3 on the other, and then the big one in the middle, or the one in the middle, was that this thing was done out of 1 piece of pure beaten gold. And it has several characteristics. A, it's heavy. Now, in years past, I've gone through at the current price of gold, tried to estimate about, you know, what a talent of gold would weigh and how much this this menorah weighed. Probably somewhere between 50 and 70 pounds. We're talking multi-million dollars worth of gold, any way you slice it, even at suppressed prices. To build this thing. But what's also interesting is it's pure gold. It keeps saying pure gold over and over again. Now, if it's pure gold is it works very nicely. You can beat it and bend it, and it's ductile and malleable. You can beat it thin. But it also has this characteristic. It's pretty soft. You make this menorah out of pure gold, you set it on the table, and the little outside ends are going to bend down under their own weight. It ain't going to last. There's something miraculous going on here with this menorah, that it stands up. Now, the other thing that's miraculous is that almost any metal worker will tell you, we don't have the skill, metallurgically, to beat this thing out of 1 piece of gold. It took some kind of, well, almost Ruach-inspired capability to be able to beat out of 1 piece of pure gold the menorah, and then to have it stand up under its own weight, too. So a lot of miraculous stuff going on here. A lot of descriptions of this as well. Okay, he made the altar of incense out of acacia wood. It was a cubit in length and in breadth, four square. In other words, it was four sides square. Two cubits high, had horns of one piece with it. That too was overlaid with pure gold, the sides, the horns, and had a crown of gold around it. Two golden rings under the crown upon the ribs thereof on the two sides, so that it could also be borne by staves. And the staves were, again, made out of acacia wood. There were long sticks overlaid with gold. Then he made the other things. This guy is talented. He's got a team helping him that are all inspired by the Ruach, but he's got the holy anointing oil, the incense, the spices. And then it says in chapter 38, he made the altar of burnt offering out of acacia wood. 5 by 5 cubits, four square. It was 3 cubits high with horns on it, and he overlaid it with brass. Harder material to work, probably, than the gold. Made all the vessels of the altar, pots, shovels, basins, flesh hooks, fire pans, and the vessels. And he made for the altar a grating of brass and 4 rings for the 4 ends to be holders for the staves. It's got to be carried as well. Acacia wood. This time they're covered like the altar itself with brass. He put the staves in the rings to allow it to be carried and made it hollow with planks. Then he made the laver out of brass. And had mirrors of the serving women that did service at the door of the tent of meeting. Made the court for the south side with the hangings, fine twine linen, 100 cubits. We talked about the pillars and the sockets of brass, fillets out of silver. North side, 100 cubits, 20 pillars, 20 sockets. Again, brass, hooks of the pillars, fillets of silver. West side, 50 cubits, pillars 10, sockets 10. And east side, 50 cubits, and the hangings again. For one side, 15 cubits, pillars 3, and their sockets 3. The chapter and the Torah portion, Vayechel, are going to finish with just the descriptions of the rest of what it is that Bezalel and Aholiab are making. On the other side, this hand and that hand by the gate of the court, were hangings, 15 cubits, pillars 3, sockets 3. All the hangings of the court round about were made of fine twined linen. Sockets for the pillars out of brass, hooks of the pillars, and fillets out of silver. They overlaid their capitals with silver, and all the pillars were filleted with silver. These are heavy sockets for all of this stuff. You can imagine this is going to be not only a heavy thing to carry, it can take a lot of people to carry it, but once it's put in place, it's going to be pretty stout as well, with a nice base to it. The screen for the gate of the court was the work of the weaver. Colors, blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twine linen. 20 cubits in length. The height was 5... The breadth of the height was 5 cubits, answerable to the hangings of the court. This one had 4 pillars and 4 sockets out of brass, hooks of silver, overlaying their capitals and their fillets with silver. And the pins, it says, of the Mishkan and of the court round about were all of brass. Now, interestingly, that's kind of right where it ends. So it ends with a description. And if you step back and you look at it, you say, okay, well, you know, this is one of those Torah portions where, again, there's not a whole lot of discussion. It's not like we see a lot of storyline that's developed or anything of the sort. And probably 80% of it or so is in this category of redundancy, stuff that we've heard before. And I'll say it one more time. I think what is important about that is that it is the redundancy itself. It's the emphasis that's being placed on it. And if you really step back and look at it, it's a darn simple portion. It starts with Moshe assembling what? Kol ha-edat of the Kahal. Vayekel. He assembled the Kahal. All of the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. He said, here's what you're going to do. Starts with the Sabbath. And then we get a whole litany of things that are going to be built, but the emphasis on willing hearts, wise-hearted, willing-hearted, over and over again. People are going to bring this and do this, and then there's the list. And I read into that essentially, after what a friend of ours calls the unfortunate incident with the golden calf, now there does seem to be a healing that's going on. And the healing is multiple fold. A, they didn't die. They've been warned, you're going to keep the Sabbath. That's a good way not to die. Understand that that is what is to be set apart. It's the singular symbol that leads into all of this. And we get the second telling and the idea that, okay, now, here's what you're going to do. And we're going to get a telling that says, look, here's what they did. And the implication is there is healing going on here. And this too was part of the plan all along.